The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Now, Jamie Heaslip joins us in studio. His biography is called All In. I'm going to read out this paragraph, Jamie, if you don't mind, from the second last page of the book.
Okay.
It's your sort of resume, your rugby CV.
Yeah.
It's very impressive. So when I look back at my career, I'm really happy because I got nearly 14 years as a professional. I had a good run. I had a lot of success. I played 229 times for Leinster, the most capped forward of all time, scoring 38 tries. I completed the full 80 minutes for Ireland in 72 of my 95 caps and scored 13 tries. I got two Lions tours and played in five test matches. I won three European Cups, one Challenge Cup, three league titles, three Six Nations, two Triple Crowns, was part of a Lions series win, and of course the Grand Slam 2009. And you say in an earlier page that all of that was topped by the day you got married to your wife.
Yep.
Really?
That and my daughter being born were, have been the highlights.
Have they?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean, that's what real life is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, rugby has been great, been a great journey. It's given me a lot, being able to provide for my family, but family is what really is the pure joy of life, I think.
You were standing out there listening to Reese McClenaghan.
Yeah.
Were you like that as well? Were you focused from an early age?
Oh, not as focused as him. Particularly in, it's funny, I bumped into him and it's crazy, you know, you can have a game where you play eight out of 10 or 8.5 out of 10 and the other lads can kind of help you out, but he's all on his own. You know what I mean? And that's the difference. And that's when you got to take your hat off, because when it's go time, like, there's no second chance with them and there's no one else left to blame, and it's all on you.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing. You know, and some achievement that he has now, and he has a great opportunity ahead of him.
Yeah, brilliant. The team thing is, because you can, when you're having a poor game, you can sort of, not that you can hide, but you know, there's very few days that you're having a mare and everybody else having a brilliant game.
Yeah, it's funny, like I always say, as well, the other thing about like sport, team sports and rugby as well, because there's so many different kind of body shapes and skills that are needed in different positions, you know, you've such a range of people that no one individual can really... Most of the time, you could argue with Johnny Sexton right now, but no one really is the big game changer. It's all about that strength of the collective. And I think the really successful teams are, it's the strength of their collective.
Team.
And they can just interchange people as well, which is a real strength of a good squad.
So you're a Kildare man as well. You went to Newbridge College.
Yeah.
So you played senior Cups rugby.
I did, yeah.
How did you do when you were there?
Not great.
No? Okay.
I don't think I won anything until... first thing I won was with Trinity, and I won an under-20s All-Ireland. So right. I didn't win anything until then.
Yeah. Your dad was very high up in the Irish Army. Is that Brigadier General, is that the top rank?
No. I think Chief of Staff is the top rank. And I think there's four... If I'm right, someone will correct this. If I'm wrong, I'm sure. I think there's four Brigadier Generals
underneath
the Chief of Staff.
So you're second, second from the top.
Ireland, and then out there's different postings outside of Ireland. And I think my dad was Brigadier General outside of Ireland.
And was he a disciplinarian at home? I think that is a yes.
Yeah, but I think he'd given up the go by the time it came to me.
Why? You were
like, I always say I was the one that got past the keeper.
Right.
My sister's 8 years older than me, my other brother's 10 years, and my eldest brother's 12 years older than me. So I think I'm the result of a foreign posting in Japan, in Israel. And I think, you know, by the time I became like a teenager, you know, everyone else had left the coop and my dad was just like, oh, just give him what he wants and get him out of here. Like, but I think he, you know, he was old school, not tough, but definitely liked structure and discipline, and a lot of it rubbed off on me. But I think as well, there was a bit of a generation gap and difference in between us. We probably clashed heads at times.
What age was he when you were born? Do the maths there in your head.
I'm doing the maths in my head. He was in his early 40s, I believe.
Not too bad.
Yeah. Early 40s.
Yeah, not too bad.
I think he was just like, oh, I thought I was done.
Yeah.
And here we go. But no, look, it was great and got to travel a lot about it off the back of his work. you know.
And Graham, your older brother, he was a rugby player too.
Yeah, and in the army too.
Right.
Yeah, so
okay.
Graham was in the army and he took 2 years leave of absence from the job. I think you could do that at the time, and was professional in Connacht, when one of the first professionals in Ireland when the game went pro in late 90s. And yeah, he captained Connacht for a while, and I believe he got an Ireland A cap at the time.
Right.
So he set the bar pretty high, and I tried to chase him down.
It's 25 years since rugby went professional. I read that somewhere recently.
Yeah, I went professional after the 95 World Cup. So,
just on 25 years. Yeah. Do you think you would have liked the amateur game?
I'm lucky. I got to play a little bit of amateur in Trinity. So even though it was a university club, you're still playing senior rugby in the AAL, and you're going up against guys who are, you know, they seem like they're ancient to you, but they might be 10 years older than you at the time, and it was very, very different. So you got a taste of what that was like. But I wouldn't change anything for the world for what I've experienced in terms of seeing how the game has. I went pro in 2005, how the game has transformed over that time. You know, I was trying to tell someone, like, we literally, in 2005, playing for Leinster, you might have a couple of thousand people in Donnybrook Stadium watching you. Now, like, they sell out the Aviva Stadium against Munster. It's just insane.
This isn't going to be chronological, Jamie. We're going to jump from here to there to everywhere.
Yeah.
So, seeing as you mentioned that, the contrast between those couple of hundred people or a couple of thousand people watching a provincial, interprovincial game to the one that you ran out onto the pitch in Croke Park.
Yeah, yeah.
Leinster v Munster.
Yeah.
Was that full that day?
That was full, and it's something we talk about, but it was a real turning point for Leinster, but I think for the game in general. Like, what's Croker's,
82,000.
So we had 82,000 people there, and I'll never forget it, running out into the field, and it was like a checkered flag of red and blue just around it. Very different in 2006 when we played in the semi-final. It was like 80% red. And it was just like, it was a pretty cool moment, to just separate to the outcome of the game, but from a spectator point of view, just seeing that 82,000 people in Croke Park as well, of all places, was just,
how do you
it
deal
was
with
amazing.
That? How do you deal with that?
Oh, you buzz off it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You get it. Like, I mean, you get really excited. I mean, that's what you want to play on the big stage and the big moments and be involved in them. And that was one of those moments.
And what do you stand there, look around, and
I always like I did always like taking it in. So I think if you look back, any time I came onto the field, I kind of do a little. I used to run out into the field. And as we're making a way to kick off, I do a kind of little pirouette, for want of a better word, and I just look around.
Right.
Because I'd be like, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then you flick into game mode and you're like, on we go.
And you have rituals as well.
Yeah.
You walk on the pitch barefoot.
Yeah. So I used to go up to the sideline with my flip-flops, take them off and kind of walk around the pitch, get a, in my own head, it was like, I get a feel for it and I ground myself and
where did you come up with that idea?
I've read about it somewhere. I just like the idea of ground. Like, I talk about the scripting and stuff,
yes,
like that in the book, and it's all like, a lot of it are triggers for you to kind of get into that state you want to be in, but also just kind of calm you down, and it's one thing that you can do all the time and you kind of get the same feeling, and it's another thing that kind of you tick the box and you kind of get you closer
and
closer.
It's habit as well. It's habit. So you don't have to think about it.
Exactly.
And
it gives you a bit of comfort and confidence as well.
Right.
But I always like the feeling of just kind of grounding yourself in the grass.
And journaling and visualization.
Yeah.
So these are big parts of your professional rugby career.
Yeah. Big parts. Yeah.
So talk me through the journaling first.
The journaling, I do it two different ways. I'd get my notebook out, and on one page I would script, kind of, I'd write out how I wanted the day to go, kind of up to the game. So feelings, what you're seeing, you know.
So, and you'd
use a lot of metaphors.
Would you use the I or I want to? Or what?
No, it'd be more like, well, yeah, you kind of write it as you. Like,
go on,
from
give
your,
us an example. Yeah.
Your, well, I used to use, I used to write out by driving to the ground, whenever you're playing a Leinster game, for example, or an Ireland game, driving to the grounds and you'd see the sea of blue or the sea of red coming crashing into the stadium and
right,
stuff like that.
Right. So descriptive, sort of.
Yeah, very emotive. And then on the other page, it'd be very prescriptive, and it'd be like, I am going to, you know, I'm going to have really good entry into my tackle, and you'd it'd be more action based.
Right.
So you'd write that, and then I do that on a game play. If you're playing on a Saturday, I do that on a Friday and a Saturday morning. And then once I get to the grounds, I just look at the actions part just before I get into the pitch.
And then, at any one time for Ireland or Leinster, there could be 25, up to 25 plays, and these are all covered.
Yeah. There's plays.
There's great insight into the machinations of rugby here.
Yeah. Yeah, there's I suppose the best way to describe it is we have a playbook, essentially. And then each game, we would narrow that down to different moves.
Depending on the opposition.
Yeah, and different permutations of different moves and stuff like that. And a way of playing and a system of playing. And some, you would just kind of use the different moves depending on the team. And Ireland this weekend, for example, let's say I've held a couple of those moves back and they'll employed them on the game sheet this week.
So up against Scotland, Japan, Samoa and Russia, they wouldn't have used some of their best moves. So, because if they did...
They might have used them to set them up as well. You might show a picture or a shape, as we call it, for New Zealand that they're looking at, that you're kind of going to tweak something off it. So they did a move, got the one that Rob Kearney scored against, was it Russia or Samoa? I can't remember. The one where Jordy Murphy passes back inside to him, that's called a Bally, well, it used to be called a Bally 210.
And they just shouted out, Bally 210.
They can tweak that as well to all sorts of different permutations.
Fascinating. And you'd have to know all those.
That's where the visualization comes in, because obviously you run through it a lot and you walk through it a lot. So you run through it on the field at real time speed, walk through it a lot really slow. And then visualization studies have shown that, if you've good practices, you're kind of firing the same neural pathways as when you physically do it.
Uh-huh.
So you ingrain it. So it becomes automatic when someone Johnny calls it out.
You're into autopilot nearly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's the best way to describe it. And then, when guys are in that kind of, I got slagged off for saying this, when they're in that state of flow, most of the stuff is autopilot, but it's built on repetition that you've done.
Because you were sort of ahead of everybody else in a lot of things. You like your gadgetry, and you were doing things that people weren't doing. You were monitoring you'd get up in the morning and you fill in a questionnaire.
Everyone did that. Okay. Yeah.
But in other things, you had a tent, sort of a...
I had an altitude tent.
Tent.
Yeah, I did that. My wife wasn't, God love her, she had a lot of patience.
Where did you set it up, in the sitting room or in the bedroom?
Originally, I set it up over our bed.
Right.
And,
so Sheena was beside you, outside the tent.
Yeah.
Right, great.
No, she was beside me in the tent.
Oh, right.
She was in the tent. Right. It went over as a double. I was very considerate like that. But yeah, it's literally like a tent that you kind of pumped reduced air, reduced oxygen. And
what was the theory behind that?
Train low, live high. So basically you would rest at high altitude and your body would form a lot of red blood cells. So when you trained at low altitude, you would have all these extra red blood cells that would help you aerobically recover. Now, it only lasts, you have to do it for about 3-4 weeks and the effect of it only lasts for about 3-4 weeks. I thought it worked anyway. I believe in the science behind it, but I only did it at the start of the season because the way it was happening for me is my first game usually was the Interpro and then you went straight into Europe. So you didn't have time to dawdle about.
A lot has been made over the years that how many full games you played and how injury free you were.
Yeah.
Has that anything to do with your sort of skewed testosterone reading?
I don't know.
Tell them how you found out about that.
Well, yeah. I had a scare, basically. I think it was the end of my first season, and I'd done testing, and we were playing a competition called Churchill Cup, and I think it was that testing, and I went away on holidays, came back. My dad picks me up at the airport. I was going back to Nace with him. He hands me all my posts, going through it, open up a letter, pretty much saying you've failed a drug test, and we're opening up your sample B. So I was like, well, what? I was like, do I tell my dad? Do I just say nothing? And then I say it to my dad, and he goes straight into army mode, straight into very practical next step mode. And then we pull into Nace, and he's like, right, not a word to your mother. So I was like, I could literally...
Don't worry.
I could probably kill someone. My dad would bury the body and my mom would never know. But anyway, so we get onto Arthur Tanner at the time, and we dive into what the actual problem was. Because obviously the first thing is have you taken anything? I was like, no. But I obviously take take whatever different kind of supplements you're taking around the game. And you're always worried that something could be tampered with, obviously, and the paranoia kicks in. But essentially, you're like, no, I haven't taken anything. Right. So you dive into it. We figure out that they'd actually changed the way they test is they look for ratios a lot of the time.
Testosterone to
epitestosterone.
And it's supposed to be 1-to-1.
Yeah, I'm not too sure what the ratio is meant to be. And then, they changed the ratio, I think, on January 1st that year, and mine was outside it. And when they looked into the actual sample, they saw it was naturally produced and stuff like that. So then the real problem became like, oh, you actually might have something
wrong.
You could have cancer, you could have a tumor or something like that. And then that's actually what the real scare was. So I had to go off and do a barrage of tests, but everything was fine. It was just the way I was built.
Just a lot of testosterone.
Yeah, just right. Just the way I was built.
Did you get slagging after that?
I did. I got a lot of slagging. But I think it helped with recovery. Not like I'm not the strongest or the biggest person, but I think it helped a lot with recovery.
Mm. Eddie O'Sullivan would have said to you, you weren't the biggest person.
Yeah.
He's a recurring theme in the book.
You always need a baddie, don't you, in the story?
Now you're doing punditry alongside him.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it gets quite interesting on it. You know, he has a very different perspective, a manager's coaching point of view. I have a player's perspective on it. It'd be boring if we all had the same opinion. And as player... coach, when we were both there, we probably had very different opinions, and like that's life. You can't, you know, not everyone can like you or agree with you.
Right.
You're looking at me like I have two heads there, right?
So who didn't like who? Was it that you didn't like him or he didn't like you?
Well, I didn't appreciate that he couldn't get my name right for the first couple of times that we met. So
what did he call you?
He called me my brother's name.
Oh, Graham. Right, yeah.
Which, as a young fellow coming through, that's the last thing you want to be referred to as your brother. You want to be your own man, I suppose. And I probably didn't help the situation. I was tended to be a little bit stubborn and... you know, strong-headed when I was young. I like to think that I've eased up a little bit, but I don't know.
I just reading the book, part of that sort of strong-mindedness is the reason you were so successful. You know, that you might say that was a weakness, but it wasn't a weakness. Obviously, you were very focused.
Yeah,
and that's the name of the book, All In.
And to be honest, like, I mean, it kind of, when we were even... throwing titles around for the book, I just, like, when people ask me, like, I've had loads of different people who've been really strong influence, but in terms of like the person that really pushed me to go all in on being a good pro was actually Mick Kearney.
What's the quote? I have it written down there somewhere. He said to you about being a pro.
Yeah, he I mean, the way he framed me, so Mick was originally part of like this scheme that our player association have of kind of having business guys mentor players and different things, and I got paired with Mick before he was the Ireland manager, and chatting away to Mick, he was just like, look, rugby, you've got a finite time playing, you're going to be really, really lucky if you have a career after rugby that like A, pays you the same or is the same type of lifestyle as while playing. So like, number one thing I'm going to say to you is invest in yourself to extend this for as long as you can. And kind of, I had approached rugby with a very kind of business kind of thinking around it. And when he kind of said it like that, I was like, geez, he's dead right. Like.
And when he said invest in yourself, he didn't mean financially, or did he mean a bit of financially and in you as a person?
He kept it, he kept it fairly broad, you know what I mean? But my takeaway from it was investing in looking at the picture, looking at it like in a whole picture and what parts of it, investing yourself to make each different part of it, you know, as best as you can. And I always like to say from like when I was playing that I want to take that peg off, do everything I can. And when I hang the jersey back on the peg, that I've kind of left that, I've given it all I can and I've done all I can and I've left it in a better place. And that's what I wanted to be able, when I finished my career, to say that. Okay. And I like to think that that's...
And the finish didn't come as you would have liked.
No.
Like, it was a sort of a non-event of an injury.
Well, not to me, right?
No, I know. I mean, to the outside world. Yeah. Like, it was during warm. It wasn't like you were sort of making a big tackle to a try-saving tackle or going for a try.
No, the way it came about, you know, just warming up and hitting that bag.
You just do this tackling thing where they hold up these big...
Yeah, the Pistons drill, we call it. And I think the lads still do it in their warm-ups. And yeah, like it's a drill you've done, I did the week before against Wales and done many a times. But, you know, I just obviously just whatever, hit the bag in a certain way when the guy was holding it. And straight away I knew I was in trouble.
You lost the feeling in your leg.
Lost power in my leg. And it was a bit of scary.
Because we had
scary proposition.
And
I was dodging questions to beat the band.
You were dodging questions, You were dodging questions to beat the band because it wasn't, you know, it didn't happen on the pitch, you know, and you were sort of...
Well, it did, but just not in, like, it wasn't front and centre.
Yes, it wasn't front and centre, So then, and you weren't willing to offer
Well, that
up.
Was a different... Yeah, that, well, not that I wasn't willing to open up, but, and I still believe in this point that it's got to be, it's the player's right to hold back medical information, just like it is for you with RTE or whoever, whether it's their employer as such. It's not on their employer to be allowed to share that information. And I think...
This would be Leinster or the IRFU or Leinster shouldn't have...
At the time, I just thought it was the information was just passed on without much thought around it.
Okay.
And granted, I probably drew a hard line in it that was...
So you said no passing on of information about me?
Yeah.
Without my permission.
Essentially, because I kind of wanted to draw a line in the sand. Granted, I probably did it the wrong way and went a bit too hard after it, but I thought the conversation needed to start and I thought because that was the best way to start it.
I suppose for you in particular, because you were the opposite to injury prone.
Yeah.
And then by not giving information, there was a sort of an information void.
Yeah.
And what happens then?
That's the argument, obviously, to give something around it. And I completely get it, but...
What sort of rumours were you hearing about yourself?
I was hearing all sorts of different things. But there's no point even giving them any air because like there was no rhyme or reason behind any of them.
No.
And I know the same has happened to other players who've been out with long-term injuries and who have taken the same kind of tact on it. At least people or definitely the IRFU and other bodies took it into consideration going forward. Mm, and now, you know, there's a bit more thought behind it now.
Okay. You won a try of the year in 2016. You were nominated as World Player of the Year how many times?
Twice.
Wow.
Never got it though.
No,
never got it. We only have two guys who were lucky enough to take that title home, Johnny and Keith Wood.
Right. What are the moments from your career that you most frequently go back to in your head?
So this is really weird. With Leinster, it's probably 2011 Northampton final.
Oh yeah.
Everyone wrote
off.
Was
that the one where you were? What was the score at halftime?
Was it 21-6 or something like that at halftime?
Right.
Completely written off. No one thinks we're coming back and we pull it off in the second half. And if you look at the video afterwards, you'll see the trophy in the middle and the circle of lads around it. And knowing like that's the group, and the crack in the change room afterwards was like, it was mental. It was great crack. But then when I think of Ireland highlights, like obviously I've been really lucky to have a lot of success, be part of teams that were successful. In a weird way, because we won the Grand Slam early in my career, the thing that eluded me for so long was beating New Zealand.
Yes.
And 2016,
Chicago
just stands out for me.
Yeah.
Just everything, like we're in Chicago, middle of November, it's 20-odd degrees, which is just kind of a bit freakish. We're playing in an NFL stadium. I love NFL. It's like a coliseum as well. It's all blacks and we pull it off, you know.
Which brings us nicely on to this Saturday morning.
Yeah. And like these guys.
So 5 years ago, we would have thought, well, this is it, we're done. But now we've beaten them twice in the last, 4 years?
Yeah. And like if Andy Farrell has been part of, and some of the players have been part of the Lions who beat them once, threw them once and lost once as well. So you have a group of players here who don't...
Farrell is the backs coach.
The backs coach who will be the next head coach.
Yes, yeah.
Defensive coach, sorry. That group of players, Joe and the backroom staff, like... They won't be afraid of the All Blacks, and it's going to be like I'm really excited about it because the guys like this team can do it. They've done a lot of firsts over this last 4 year period. Beat South Africa the first time in their soil. Beat the All Blacks twice. You could argue maybe three times.
They beat Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand in the one calendar year.
Yeah, I mean, it's unheard of.
Yeah,
they've been every top tier side. I think this is just these guys can
and
do
they
it.
Have one big game in them. I think. They haven't played their best yet in this tournament.
No, but they've done, like, okay, bar the Japan result, they've done what they've had to do, yeah. Right? And, like, are they capable of winning? 100% okay. They're capable of winning.
Great. Listen, you're lucky because you run out of time. I was going to get you to
I'm
sing.
I'm a talker.
Chasing Cars. People will have to read the book to get the significance of that.
Yeah.
Jamie Heaslip with Matt Cooper, all in. It's a great read. Jamie, thanks so much
thanks,
for coming
Ray.
In.
Thanks
Thank
as
you.
Always.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.